Hello there and welcome. Well, this week the government announced a series of changes to the rules governing asylum seekers. To risk oversimplification, it levels the playing field so that those coming by boat will now receive much the same treatment as those arriving by air. The punitive dimension of refugee policy, deliberately targeted at those arriving by boat, is to be modified. Those with a hardened eye to political opportunity may identify here another victory for Prime Minister Gillard and Immigration Minister Bowen. Labor are now able to claim the high ground in the debate. Softening the policy on boat arrivals appeases some on the left, whilst charges of weakness from the right can be met with "don't blame us, blame Tony Abbott" for blocking offshore processing. With the current makeup of the Senate, it's unlikely that the government would seek to push the offshore issue any further. All this happened to coincide with this week's celebration of the 30th anniversary of the Refugee Council of Australia, a group bringing together community and faith-based agencies to lobby on these very issues. In a few moments, we'll be joined by representatives of the Refugee Council and church bodies, and also hear from one of Australia's most distinguished public servants and former head of the Department of Immigration and Ethnic Affairs, John Menadue. And you can voice your opinions on this much-vexed topic and the changes announced by Minister Bowen by giving us a call on 1300 800 222. Don't do it yet. I'll give you a shout a little later in the program when you can give us a call to get your voice heard. 1300 800 222. In our second hour, Tom Roberts from the National Catholic Reporter in the United States will be along to talk about religion and politics in the USA as the Republicans grind through their presidential debates. And then something rather special. We'll be joined by one of those at the centre of last week's tragic fire at the nursing home in Sydney's Quakers Hill, where the death toll today reached 10. The Reverend Jeff Bates is the Anglican minister whose church became a refuge and triage centre in the aftermath of the event, and one of those whose congregation is now charged with, and one of those with whom a member of his congregation is now charged with causing the blaze and the resulting deaths. Jeff will be along in about 90 minutes' time. Then something to lighten the night, the Inquisition. Mark Franklin stepping in for Noel Debien in The Good Life, and Frank Sheehan will join us for the chat room. A very busy evening, so let's get underway.
You're listening to John Cleary on Sunday Night.
John Menadue is one of Australia's most distinguished public servants. He was head of the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet in the Whitlam and Fraser years from 1974 to 76, and from 1980 to 1983 he served as head of the Department of Immigration and Ethnic Affairs. It's an area in which he's maintained an active interest in the years since. A few moments ago, just before the program came on to air, I spoke with John Menadue and asked him his response to the changes announced by the government.
It's very welcome and long overdue. We've had this absurd position for years now that asylum seekers who come by air have their refugee claims assessed while they're living in the community. On the other hand, asylum seekers that come by boat, and that's a minority, only about 24% over the last decade, asylum seekers who come by boat are locked up. So we have this absurd situation that one group of people is assessed while they're living in the community, and the other group of asylum seekers are assessed when they're locked up in these dreadful detention centres. So I think it's a very sensible thing for the government to pursue. I remember working back in the days of the Fraser government. The Fraser government refused to set up refugee camps, detention centres, and all asylum seekers were processed while they were living in the community. So I think there's very good precedent for it. It removes this quite unreal distinction between one lot of asylum seekers and others. Hopefully, over a period, it will reduce the numbers in detention, which is at an horrific cost financially, horrific cost to individuals in terms of their mental health, It tramples on their human rights. So almost in every respect, this is a very desirable trend and policy. I know that the opposition will say, you know, it's a sign of weakness that they're not protecting our borders anymore, which is absolute nonsense. To suggest that it's got nothing whatsoever to do with border protection. It's really a matter of how you process people that we have to process by reason of their claims for refugee status.
You give no credence to the between a rock and a hard place argument. That is that unless we do have tough border protection, we are going to encourage a flood of people smuggling simply because of the pressure coming from refugees coming down out of the trouble spots of the world.
There is absolutely no basis for that proposition. The number of asylum seekers coming to Australia, it's minuscule in world terms, but it is driven by people fleeing from Iran, the security services, the politics, the mullahs, fleeing from Afghanistan, flying from Sri Lanka in the civil war. That's what drives people to flee their countries, and whatever we may do at this end in terms of trying to deter them has only a marginal effect, quite marginal. The trend since I could ever remember the figures is that the number of asylum seekers coming to Australia, and they're very few, follows world trends. And what we do this end will not deter them, or at least will not have any significant effect.
That is, it's push factors rather than pull factors.
That is right. Yeah. And we carry on in this country this obsession we have with boat people, and somehow we can put up our border protection and say, well, we're going to stop you. In fact, it doesn't work. There is no evidence whatsoever that mandatory detention, which the Hawke government introduced many years ago, has any effect whatsoever on deterring people.
You use the words boat people, which takes us back to another era entirely, the word first coined during the last period of the Vietnam War. It's been said that the public debate over refugees in the past few years has been different from that in the late 70s and early 80s, somewhat more mean-spirited. Is that your observation too, or are we using rose-coloured glasses when we look back on the policies of those years?
I think it is more mean-spirited. And that has been deliberately encouraged by, unfortunately, John Howard, Pauline Hanson, Tony Abbott, and others who see political advantage in exploiting our fear of the foreigner. And we all have that fear of the foreigner. So I think it's the first time for a long time that we've had unscrupulous politicians trying to frighten us. The other factor is, of course, that since in the last 10 years, since September 11, the attacks on New York and Washington, terrorism, border protection has become a major concern of many people. The Fraser government showed that it was during the Cold War and after the fall of Vietnam that it is possible to conduct both a humanitarian policy as well as protecting one's borders. And the Canadians do it, for example, and many other countries can do it successfully. It can be done, but unfortunately, there are politicians in this country now, which we haven't had for a long time, who are attempting to exploit our fear of the foreigner. Malcolm Fraser had the advantage during the Indochina outflow of 1.4 million people from Indochina that broadly the policies that he followed successfully were supported by Gough Whitlam and then Bill Hayden. But we haven't had for quite a time groups of political leaders in this country who deliberately try to take political advantage over people fleeing persecution, wanting an opportunity for freedom, an opportunity for a start to a new life in a new country. These people are desperate. They are being persecuted, killed, and murdered. But unfortunately, we have people that try and play politics over their plight.
Notwithstanding the changes, there do appear to be a continued toughening of assessment appeals Is there a culture in the Department of Immigration that may at times be at odds with the sensibilities that prevail at the political level? I mean, we have periodic instances of what appear to be quite harsh treatment of individual cases and no access to them on the grounds of all their security assessments are not privy to the public.
I believe that, if I could describe, the centre of gravity of the department has moved increasingly in terms of enforcement, policing, border protection. Any refugee policy in any Department of Immigration has to be concerned about border protection, ensuring that the government keeps control of what happens on our borders. But that has to be balanced by the political facts that we need to be humane and decent in the way we treat people who are fleeing for their lives from persecution, in many cases from murder and rape. So we need to get those two in balance. Unfortunately, I think the department now has very much been influenced by a culture of enforcement and policing, and that's why we are seeing, unfortunately, these delays, increasing security checks. The tail is wagging the dog, unfortunately, in my view, in the department, and that needs addressing by some administrative and changes in the balance between humanitarian and border issues. And in my view, it needs to take those humanitarian refugee issues outside of the department and leave the department to enforcement, which it seems to love, and have a separate authority responsible, as the Canadians do, for refugee policy.
What about the politics of the situation, as also it's changed quite radically in the last few days with the Peter Slipper speakership? The government could now move to offshore processing, as was indicated by members of the opposition the other day, but it may no longer be in their political interest to do so. They are now able to satisfy some more on the left by having a more compassionate attitude and bring people in for onshore processing and fend off the right by simply saying, well, it's all Tony Abbott's fault. He wouldn't let us go for the offshore solution.
I think the fact is that even though the government has really stolen a march on Tony Abbott in the House of Representatives, and its position there is strengthened, and the prospects of changing legislation is probably enhanced, but that, nothing has changed in the Senate, and it's very clear that the Greens would not approve any changes. So the politics of it would seem to me to suggest that it isn't worth the effort of introducing new legislation, which the Greens and the opposition will oppose. I think what is being lost in all this discussion about Malaysia and offshore processing is that, assuming that we have to process onshore in Australia, we still do need to build up our relationships with the countries of our region. My experience with working with the Fraser government is that we would never have been able to manage the major outflow from Indochina and the subsequent resettlement in Australia, Canada and elsewhere. We'd never been able to manage that without the cooperation of countries such as Malaysia, Thailand and Indonesia. And it is still the case today. Unfortunately, in this country, we're inclined to be very critical of countries such as Malaysia, although the way they treat asylum seekers is probably pretty mild compared with the way we treat asylum seekers in our detention centres, and it is quite barbaric the way we perform. So I think in terms of the region, Malaysia, we still need to build an effective relationship with the countries of our region. They are doing far more than we are doing in terms of the hundreds of thousands of asylum seekers in their countries, particularly now coming out of Burma or Myanmar, as it is called today. We need their cooperation into the future, and unfortunately that is being lost in this byplay we're having over swaps and Malaysia.
John Menadue, thanks so much for giving us your time.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to John Cleary on Sunday Night.
John Menadue there, head of the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet in the Whitlam and Fraser years from 1974 to 76 and from 1980 to 1983, the head of the Department of Immigration and Ethnic Affairs. Well, now it's a pleasure to welcome into the studio Paul Power from the Refugee Council of Australia and in Melbourne, Kaz Coleman, immediate past CEO of the Hotham Mission and their Asylum Seeker Project, and Kaz is also a current member of the Council of Immigration Service Status Resolution, which advises the Minister on immigration issues. Welcome to you both after a somewhat surprising week.
Certainly has been.
Thanks, John.
Paul Powell, let me ask you first, and Kaz, I'll get you to respond as well. Before we get into the changes announced by the government, can I get your response to John Menadue's views on the current state of the Department of Immigration that he just indicated in that interview, saying the tail is wagging the dog and they become more concerned with border protection than with the humanitarian dimension of immigration? Paul?
Well, certainly the Department of Immigration has been under enormous amount of political pressure for quite a long time, and you know, I think we've seen changes in the department and even changes of the naming of different divisions within the department, which actually illustrate this. About 18 months ago, the division responsible for refugee policy was the Refugee, Humanitarian and International Division. Today it's the Border Security, Refugees and International Division. So I think that says a lot, that you know, border security policy and the Australia's humanitarian program seem to be intrinsically linked. And I think one of the challenges for you know, people within in the Department of Immigration has been this, as John pointed out, this question of conducting Australia's humanitarian program while also being seen to be the people who keep the borders safe. One of the issues that I feel has been sort of bubbling behind the scenes probably more the bureaucratic discussion, but leads into the political discussion, is the belief amongst many in the Department of Immigration that Australia's universal visa system, the process by which citizens of every country other than New Zealand must apply for some form of visa, is critical to the maintenance of democracy and the safety of the Australian people. And of course, those who seek asylum and arrive without a visa are quite an anomaly to some extent, a threat to this universal visa system. But I mean, that stands in contrast to Australia's commitment under the Refugee Convention, which was basically, you know, when people believe they have a well-founded fear of persecution, no matter how they've arrived, but to give them a fair hearing.
Yes. Kaz, a number of issues we've got to explore here, but your reaction first to John Menadue's comments about the department itself, and you're somebody who gets a chance to talk to the minister about these things from time to time.
Yes, and I guess I'd acknowledge that John has had a longer history, obviously working with the department, than I have, but certainly currently get a chance to talk with them often about the changes. And just picking up on something Paul said, and that was that when we talk about the people in the Department of Immigration, and I think we do need to remember that they are people, public servants who are constrained by political processes, and perhaps if I can be short and say that it's been some time since I've seen some happy Department of Immigration people, and really I think the expansion of community detention over the past year, and also this announcement around the community processing on bridging visas, is giving people who work for the department some relief in that there are some positive moves forward.
Kaz, what about John Menadue's view that the department would be helped by some sort of restructure which separates these areas of enforcement and humanitarian operations?
Look, I think there are some real challenges in the current structure, and Paul's pointed out some of them. I think that is obvious too on the ground with clients who it may be harder to work with people around compliance versus processing when it's seen it's coming from the same department. It can develop a lack of trust for clients in the process. I think there are some challenges, but I think that at the moment we're going to have our hands full in developing a good community processing system, And we're going to need a lot of organisations to come on board with that and to get this done in a way that it can be sustainable into the future.
You're on Sunday night on ABC Radio around Australia through Radio Australia and via the web to the world. John Cleary with you. Our guests in the studio this evening are Paul Power and Kaz Coleman. We're talking about the announced changes to Australia's immigration intake, particularly with regard to boat people, to refugees arriving by boats, and the introduction of more bridging visas and onshore processing for those arrivals announced just this week. Coincidentally, only on the occasion of the 30th anniversary of the Refugee Council of Australia. And, of course, that throws into relief the attitudes then and now. Do we treat refugees these days any different and perhaps in a somewhat worse manner than we treated them 30 years ago when the influx of something like 1.4 million people coming out of Southeast Asia in the wake of the Vietnam War was what confronted bureaucrats and policymakers. We handled it rather differently then. You can give us a call, 1300 800 222. I asked John Menadue, Paul Power, whether or not we're viewing the past with rose-coloured glasses. He indicated not, that in fact there was a bipartisan-ish attitude to the issue of refugees and asylum seekers flowing out of Southeast Asia, and that generally this was one of support for, and a bipartisan view that the Australian people had to be encouraged to view things more openly and not so defensively.
Yeah, I think if you look at Australia's history of migration policy and refugee policy from the Second World War, really until probably the mid-1990s, the Australian government tended to lead public opinion in a quite positive way. Certainly the introduction of a widespread continental European migration after the Second World War didn't come because of the at the request of the Australian people. It wasn't due to a groundswell of public opinion. It was actually something which the political leaders at the time actually argued for and put the case to the Australian people. And we saw the same in the government's response in the late 1970s and early 1980s to the Indo-Chinese refugee crisis. Ian McPhee, when he was immigration minister, and Mick Young as shadow minister, travelled to various parts of Australia together to talk to communities about this issue, to actually convince them that this was something that could work. It was part of our moral responsibility because of our involvement in the Vietnam War and the support of the South Vietnamese government, and our country was looking at supporting people who were victims of persecution of the government of Vietnam. So also I think in the context of the battle between the communist bloc and Western democracies, it was perhaps a little easier to persuade people of the need to protect people who were fleeing what was widely regarded by Australians as a common enemy. Today the world's much more complex, but also we've seen for the past 15 or more years, politicians, as John Menadue has said, trying to exploit the situation.
If you'd like to give us a call, 1300 800 222, on ABC Radio around Australia. What's the current attitude to refugee policy in your mind? Is the change a good one? Is it a bad one? We're talking with Kaz Coleman and Paul Power this evening on the 30th anniversary of the Australian Council for Refugees, and also in the wake of the announcements this week by Chris Bowen, the Immigration Minister. Kaz Coleman, it'd be a very exciting thing to see the current Immigration Minister and his opposite number in the country, although I doubt that the political circumstances these days would allow it.
Sorry, John, in terms of Chris Bowen, sorry, I missed your question.
Well, I doubt that the political circumstances these days would allow the Immigration Minister and his counterpart on the opposite side to tour in an atmosphere of bonhomie.
Oh, yes, in relation to past. Well, yeah. It certainly would be an interesting sight to see. I agree. I'm not sure we're there at the moment. But I think it is an exciting time. I don't want to rain on Paul's parade and the Refugee Council of Australia, but the Christian churches in Australia have been cooperating on this issue since 1948, when the Christian World Service was set up and is now, of course, called Act for Peace. And I think over that time we've seen faith-based organisations working with refugees in a range of ways, most notable through the Community Refugee Settlement Scheme, which went for 20 years, and many church communities were involved in supporting and receiving people under a banner of hospitality, if you like. And since then have moved on, I think, to more interest in people arriving by sea, temporary protection visa holders, and more awareness of what community processing needs to look like. And certainly this move, I think, brings us in line with some other countries around the world who have far greater numbers than we do, but still manage to process people in the community effectively.
Let's talk about, you raise the issue of the origins of the Refugee Council of Australia and the background of the churches in this. Paul Power, there was active church involvement in the formation of the Refugee Council, was there not?
Yes, certainly was. The Refugee Council was formed principally by AusCare in 1981, and AusCare was an alliance of organisations which were raising funds together for refugee programs overseas. But as Australia's refugee program, its resettlement program, developed in the wake of the Indo-Chinese refugee crisis, the need for a national council looking at, specifically at domestic policy became greater. The founding president of the Refugee Council was Major General Paul Cullen, who was also president of AusCare. And on the original board, there were of the seven organisations represented, five of them were faith-based organisations, one Jewish and four Christian. And that's, while the proportions have changed a little in relation to our membership, today we've got 153 member organisations and 48 of them are faith-based organisations, and of course the majority of them representing Christian churches. And some of our strongest support comes from the Catholic Uniting and Anglican churches.
Cass Coleman, it's an interesting thing here that whilst churches are very strong on the policy level, it's something of a paradox that's not always reflected in the pews. That is, polls indicate that the sort of attitudes on many of these issues, sort of people who go to church, is even a little to the right of the general community. What explains this?
Well, I think to a large degree it's a latent issue around the belief that faith-based organisations or religious bodies shouldn't be commenting on politics, or that is a realm that is not something to be meddled in. I think over time we've seen that change, but there is still, I think, a latent belief that people can have their own opinions and that churches shouldn't meddle in politics. But certainly when we look at the foundation of particularly with the Christian churches, I guess, in terms of approaching refugees under the themes of hospitality but also dignity of the human person, some of the things we've seen implemented in Australia in the treatment of refugees certainly doesn't align with the dignity of the human person. And I think we are getting to a stage where we're coming more in line with this. And on the ground, you're right, there is a range of views, but there always has been amongst the denominations of any religious body where there are different denominations. And perhaps one of the exciting things, though, I think at the moment, is that there's really going to be some opportunities for interfaith interaction with the expansion of community processing. And already we've seen that around community detention, where one example I can think of where a Christian organisation is providing case management for some young Afghan minors. A secular organisation is providing the residential care and employing Muslim carers. And there's a really great opportunity, I think, for some good interfaith engagement around the care and support of refugees in the community.
You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio. Time to take some of your calls on this issue. It's the 30th anniversary of the Australian Refugee Council, but it's also the week in which the Minister, Chris Bowen, announced some changes to refugee policy, particularly around the issue of bridging visas. You may want to give us your opinion on 1300 800 222. Let's take your calls. Paul Power and Kaz Coleman are our guests. Let's say hi to Shane on the Mornington Peninsula. Hello, Shane. What would you like to say?
Yeah, g'day, John. Look, It's only obvious, I believe, you know, we should let in whoever, really, because, or I shouldn't say we, but the people who really control the country will probably just bring in millions and millions of people. It's obvious that in England, when it had a huge population about 30 or 40 years ago, they let in about 11 million people, and the same people who control England probably control Australia. And it's obvious that this is a no-brainer, that they're going to let in millions of people. It's obvious that that's happening right now.
Not without a touch of irony there. Paul, your response to what Shane's observed.
Well, in terms of the refugee and humanitarian program, it's very tightly controlled. There is a cap, in effect, of 13,750 places, which occasionally they may go 30 or 40 places over that. But certainly in relation to the refugee program, Australia has one of the most tightly regulated and tightly controlled programs of any in the world. So we're certainly the only country that attempts to put an absolute cap on the number of people who come to Australia to seek asylum and are recognised, as well as those who are resettled. I think Australia's migration program, of course, it's a matter for public debate as to how it should be handled, but certainly the everything that we see, and we're involved in close discussions with the Department of Immigration on a very regular basis, is that the program is pretty carefully planned. I certainly recognise that people have different views about the ultimate size of the country.
Shane, thanks for your call. We are going to have to move on. Lots of calls on the board to Alan now. Hello, Alan. Welcome to you. What would you like to say?
Well, I just reckon it's lazy politics, really, the way they're bringing these people in. And your last speaker saying that, you know, Australia having the stringent controls, I find that laughable. I don't mean to... it's just... absolute laughable. We're being fed so much, I'm going to use a word, I might swear, crap, right? And they've got young women in the country, they're going to take their money off them for having babies too young. One part of the government was giving a massive encouragement to young women to have children. And I think the current government we've got in there, they have a term moving forward. They drop their bundle, they stuff up, they don't fix it, they move forward to something else, another thing to cover the crap behind them. It's not good enough.
Well, just go straight to the point about immigration, because we could have a general bash up on the government at any time. What's your specific...
Immigration, opinion? These people, most of them are untrained, and we're fed this rubbish that they're poor. They are not poor people when they can pay $20,000 to get a boat to Indonesia and then more money to come from Indonesia to here. They are not poor people. There's people in Australia with less than that, and we're doing nothing to help them.
Kaz Coleman, your response.
I think one of the challenges that we have is that the treatment of asylum seekers who do arrive in Australia is only one part of a bigger picture. And we do also need to remember that those who arrive by air also pay for their airfares. And there is a tricky balance between those who spend long periods of time in protracted refugee situations around the world and those who may have been able to pool resources to make the journey to Australia. That's not to say, I think, that we should pitch one against the other, but rather we need to find some ways to balance that. And an obvious one that John Menadue mentioned was that we need much greater engagement in our region. We are one of few countries who are signatories to the Refugee Convention, and that's challenging when many of those countries have far more asylum seekers in them than we do, and if they don't feel safe where they are, then they're going to keep moving, and Australia is going to be one of the places they'll move to.
Thanks, Alan, for your observations. To Peter in Canberra. Hello, Peter. Welcome. Peter, you there?
G'day, how you doing?
Yeah, good. Pete, what would you like to say?
Mate, I just want to make 2 points. But firstly, I just want to emphasise that I'm all for helping those who are in a position of being persecuted where they are. However, 2 points. My first point is those that arrive by air come with appropriate documentation. those that arrive by boat, for some reason, destroy their documentation. And that's a serious issue that Australians don't like, because Australia has, a very warm, open policy towards many, many people. However, we want people to be honest and direct. My second point, and this is where I get even more concerned, is that there are currently refugee camps dotted along that, East Asian area, where people are legitimately lining up in camps waiting to come here. There are people that have been waiting a very, very, very long time. What is going to happen to these people that can't afford, and like the gentleman earlier said, a lot of these people actually have the money to get here. You've got to ask yourself, as an Australian, I ask myself, why are they coming in through my back door when they're quite welcome coming in through the front door? Why do they take the back door? And as an Aussie, that's where I get offended, and that's where I draw the line, because if they come in through the back door and they get here, we let them in, we've already rewarded them for not respecting who we are and the country that they're going to come and make their life in.
Kaz.
One of the challenges globally is that there are not enough resettlement places. I think the figures at the moment for those of interest to the UNHCR is that there's about 1% chance of a recognised refugee by the UNHCR of being resettled in another country. That reality throws out the concept of a queue in the sense that many will not be able to even access that 1% of resettlement places. The situation it creates then is for people to look at other options. If they don't feel safe where they are, then, as I said, they will move on. And yes, some will have resources and some won't. But Australia's actually been one of the top countries in the world in offering resettlement places, and we should be proud of that. We've got an excellent settlement program. But as Paul pointed out, it's capped. It's relatively small, although on a world scale it's quite large, because many countries don't offer resettlement places because they get so many across their borders. And that's a real challenge for us. It's hard to get to Australia. We do need to keep that balance between taking people from refugee camps around the world, but we also need to acknowledge that punitive measures for those who arrive don't work in terms of stopping those who might be interested in coming.
You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio around Australia. We're talking about government changes in government policy on refugees, and also coinciding with the 30th anniversary of the Australian Refugee Council. Paul Power is our guest in the studio from the Australian Council for Refugees, and also Kaz Coleman from the Hotham, or formerly with the Hotham Mission and their Asylum Seeker Project, and many other things along the way from Melbourne. Let's take some more calls from you, but before we do, let me ask you about bridging visas and the way this has been changed, Paul. Just what are the changes and how significant are they? Because Minister Bowen was also anxious to say, oh, look, but the safeguards are there, you know, we're not just opening the floodgates. What was actually being said?
Yeah, well, I mean, the government is maintaining its policy of mandatory detention for asylum seekers who arrive without a visa, but over the next few months...
And these are basically those who are on boats.
Yeah, basically on boats, yeah. But, I mean, there are some, you know, in the low hundreds who arrive by plane without a visa, but they... there are so many restrictions on air travel to Australia that it's almost impossible, but some still do reach Australia by plane. So what will be happening over the next few months is the government will be moving to a system whereby people will be detained on arrival and will be subject to identity, health and security checks, and if and when they pass those checks and are cleared, if the government concludes that there is no risk to a person being released into the community, they'll be released on a bridging visa while their status is being determined. So at the moment, Australia is the only country in the world which actually detains asylum seekers, those who come by boat, for the entire period it takes to determine their status.
And that's not looked upon well by our fellow signatories of the Refugee Convention, is it?
No, it's not. And it's also unnecessary. I mean, the government has been maintaining for some time that detention isn't being used as a deterrent. So they say that detention is... administrative, you know, so that people will be available for the processing of their applications, but certainly doesn't feel administrative to those who've been detained. And where a person is been determined not to be a risk to the community, there's no point actually keeping them in prison-like conditions in a detention centre. So, really what they're doing is moving towards a much more common sense approach. The other change also that the minister announced was that with those whose asylum claims are being processed in Australia, they're actually going to move towards having one national system. Since 2001, we've had a different policy for those who've entered Australia through offshore territories. And over the past few years, there have been changes, and some changes were forced on the government at the beginning of this year by a High Court decision last November. And now the government has actually come to the realisation of those who were processed in Australia that it should actually be all under the one national system, which, of course, again, is also a common sense move.
Cass Coleman, can I just ask you, following up from that, it turns that this the government is now turning this High Court decision almost to its advantage in the politics of the situation. It's basically saying, OK, we can open up to bridging visas. We can't go to the route of offshore processing because the High Court's locked that off. So it therefore softens the position for those on the left, and for those on the right, those who were advocating a much tougher policy, the government can now simply say, well, look, the coalition, Tony Abbott, has blocked that route because they're the ones who have blocked it in the Senate. Oh, they blocked it in the House, and it probably would get blocked in the Senate anyway, given the changes to the Senate. It's a win-win-win for the government on this, isn't it? In politics, I'm talking raw politics here.
Well, in lots of ways, I guess you're right in saying that. Having said that, we could have gone to this move earlier. So there really is, I guess, a question about the fact that both governments now have implemented long-term mandatory detention. We have not seen better results from either of those implementations, or should I say we've not seen good results. And I think at the moment, from a political perspective, the government really, in lots of ways, didn't have a choice. I think the self-harm rates we're starting to see, the voices from the community around the model of long-term mandatory detention and the harm we were seeing. And certainly with a success rate for refugee protection of around 70 to 75% of people in detention, we are effectively implementing a policy that is damaging our future residents and citizens of this country. Now, that doesn't really make sense for the costs that we are going to have to bear, both from the health system, but also from a financial income perspective in terms of welfare, if we continue to do that. So it was a logical move, and I think you're right, has some political advantage for the government.
On Sunday night, we're taking your calls. Let's say hi to Mick in Geelong. Hello, Mick. What would you like to say?
Look, I've gone through the various views that some of your other callers have had due to the both media and government of the day convincing me that we shouldn't have queue jumpers and we should be hard and we should be deterring people from taking the risk. But the reality is, as one of your experts said, that the Nauru Pacific solution of the Howard government had simply people locked up for many years and then being released into the community as being bona fide asylum seekers. And if we've got such a pass rate, 75% or more, we should be putting our efforts into investigating those who won't give us their true identities or don't eventually qualify, and then exporting those wherever the law permits them to be sent. But for the 75%, why try and use mandatory detention as a deterrent? It hasn't worked either for the Howard government, and perhaps the Malaysian solution might have been a very harsh deterrent that stopped people coming. But the Parliament, and largely the current opposition haven't facilitated that outcome. And so I think it's time we tried onshore processing. It seems to work for the equal number of illegal immigrants who come via the air. Why not see how well this can work for those who come by boat?
Mick, thanks for that. We'll take that as a comment rather than a question, and we'll move on to other comments and questions. To First of all, let's go to Neil in Rosanna in Victoria. Hello, Neil. Welcome. Neil, you there?
Oh, I'm here in Rosanna.
Yeah, what would you like?
Tasmania.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. What would you like to say?
I think you said Victoria.
Yeah, I did. Sorry about that, Neil.
Anyway, I was just saying these supposed refugees should pay up to $2,000 plus per member of the family to get on a leaky fishing boat and come out all the way here. And then the government turns around and says, oh, yeah, we had four boats in last week. That's okay. Okay, we probably need more people here, but jet them come in the front door and say, okay, we are here. And if they chuck their papers overboard before they land, straight away send them back to where they came from.
Well, I think we've had a comment on that before, but just briefly again, Kaz, why is that not an adequate response in your view?
Well, I think in lots of ways we have to clarify what the front door is. And at the moment, again, as Paul has said, there's a capped program in terms of those we take who are recognised refugees by the UNHCR who are in camps. Unless that number increases, it's a very small window of opportunity for people. And the front door essentially is pretty much jammed closed, except for a small hole down in the right-hand corner for people and a chance to get to Australia. So it doesn't really make sense to be talking about queues and front doors, because at the moment it's far more chaotic than that, and people are in different situations in different countries, some of which provide minimal protections and others which provide none. And there really isn't a formal way of getting to Australia that many people can access. And that's reality. It's a chaotic process of people movement.
Got lots of calls on the board, so we'll try and get through a few here. We'll take a few in a line. Susan at Canamble. Hello, Susan. Welcome. What would you like to say? We've lost Susan. Sorry about that, Susan. To Anne in Northcote. Hello, Anne.
Oh, hello. Just a very quick comment. Hi, Kez. I'm Brendan's sister. I teach literature, and I just wanted to sort of reassure you that the choices that are being made by the text selectors do address this issue. I'm currently teaching a text, Two Brothers, Hanny Rayson, does address the issue. Many of my students have read Ando, Happiest Refugee, and of course The Rugmaker. So the discussions are alive and well in classrooms across Victoria.
Paul, are you aware of the way school curriculums are handling these issues generally?
No, I couldn't regard myself as an expert. I mean, we have interaction with different schools from time to time. I mean, clearly, the way in which schools choose to introduce issues such as those relating to asylum seekers and refugees obviously has a big influence on the attitudes of children. I mean, I've had a very positive experience just in recent weeks of going to a Catholic primary school in the outer southwest of Sydney, where which is supposedly one of the heartlands of anti-asylum seeker sentiment, and the Year 6 students at that school are actually raising funds for care packages for asylum seekers. So I think there had been it's quite a diverse range of kids in that school, but through education processes and giving people an opportunity to understand the personal stories behind the issues, I mean, there's a real opportunity for young Australians to actually respond in a positive manner.
Let's take another couple of calls to Jane in Majors Creek. Hello, Jane.
Oh, hello, John. I want to follow up on the last call. I regard refugees, if they're already here and being processed on shore, as being an opportunity. Refugees, they come from various countries, and particularly the ones from the Middle East, often carry with them a lot of knowledge, starting with their language, that isn't commonly taught to our younger people here. And I would like to see refugees, particularly in large regional towns, being introduced to give talks to children about 10 and 11 years old, to introduce them to the polite forms in their language and the culture, and possibly to inspire those children to want to learn that language later. And, of course, to turn into adults that are not ignorant and therefore frightened of the stranger. So that's what I have to say.
Well, thanks for the observation. Now, we'll take that as a comment and move on to Narelle in Goulburn. Hello, Narelle. Thanks for hanging on.
Thank you. Yes, I'm very pleased. I sort of welcome the change of policy. And I know that although my mother wasn't a refugee, I remember in the 70s when refugees were arriving in boats, and I can remember very clearly my mother saying they travelled first class on a ship from England. And
for £10.
Pardon?
For £10?
No. And I remember her saying when we were watching the news, and she said nobody knows what it's like to float in the darkness at sea and not know where you're going. Now that came from someone who was on a ship, who would have felt safe and secure. And I always remember that comment, and I just can't understand the thinking of people who say, you know, we've got a back door and a front door. And also the situation of these people pay. They've got all this money and they pay, but there were so many of them at the bottom of the sea that never got here, regardless of how much money they paid. And I defy anybody that if you had the money and you wanted to escape for yourself and your children to a safe country and you had the money, I defy anyone to say they wouldn't try it.
Thanks for your observations. We will we will move on to Rosalie. Hello, Rosalie.
Oh, hi. I know a lot of people are against the government spending money on ads, you know, but I really think the Australian public need to be educated. That, you know, we are an immigrant nation, and except if we're Aboriginal, we've all come from, we're descended from someone else. In my case, I'm descended from the original boat people, the convicts, the marriage of two convicts. And I had an old aunt that told me a story of my great-great-grandfather that married a free settler's daughter. And if they had an argument, she would say to him he had the cross on his back. And that was he was third generation. We just need educating.
Well, sorry about that. Look, I just want to ask one final question. Sorry that we lost that there. It was my fault. Just one final question to Kaz and to Paul. Kaz first. Do you think, in 30 seconds, that the way this issue has been fought out has really been coloured by an undertone of terrorism linked to religion?
I think that's been part of it. I think we've had some leadership over the last decade that has used demonising language around asylum seekers. And I think we've also had some very stark pictures in the media of a very visual issue around those arriving by sea, and the combination of those things, I think, has really impacted on the views of the general public.
Paul Common, final comment, 30 seconds.
Well, I think the simplistic way in which the issues have been presented is a real problem. I mean, we've heard, from some of the discussion tonight, to people calling in talking about, front doors and, proper ways and queues and the like. And, I mean, in reality, the global refugee protection system is in serious trouble, and that what we're seeing increasingly in many parts of the world, including our own, are people trying to find their own ways to safety. Unfortunately, as Australians, we have little understanding of what it's like for people in very, very difficult situations.
Paul Power and Kaz Coleman, it's been great to have you with us. Thanks so much for joining us.